I'm grateful for the opportunity once again to teach our class from the book of Job. And I want to say at the very beginning here that this has been one of the most interesting studies that I've had in a classroom situation for a long, long time. And the reason for that is because we've had such devoted students. And I deeply appreciate all of you who have been studying with us in the book of Job. We started this particular class about 2 or 3 years ago, and we've covered quite a bit of the Bible in that class, 1 o'clock on Wednesdays. And right now, of course, we're not able to meet, but we're doing the very best that we can under these conditions, and I'm glad that we can have your interest today. Perhaps you have your lesson sheet on Job 29 through 31, and I want to give you a sort of a synopsis or an overview of those chapters as we study today. Job and his friends had shared 3 rounds of speeches already, and now Job felt it was time for him to sum up his defense. And so at verse 1, chapter 29, you'll see this statement: Job continued his parable, or his discourse. And that suggests that Job may have paused and waited for Zophar to take his turn to speak, but Zophar was silent. Perhaps Zophar felt it was a waste of time to argue any more with Job. Now, in these 3 chapters, 29 and 30 and 31, Job recalled the blessings of his past, chapter 29. Then he lamented the sufferings of the present, chapter 30. And then he challenged God to vindicate him in the future, chapter 31. He climaxed his speech with 16 if I have statements, if I have. And he put himself under oath, challenging God either to condemn him or vindicate him. It was as though Job were saying, "We've talked long enough. I really don't care what you men think, you 3 friends of mine, because God is my judge, and I rest my case with him. Now, let him settle the matter, one way or another, once and for all." This has been a long, drawn-out drama here that we've been studying. We've looked at all these speeches. We've looked at Eliphaz and his speeches. We've looked at Bildad and his, and Zophar and his. Now, Job, for a while, is going to look back upon his life. There comes a time in the lives of all of us when we sort of look back, we reminisce about the past. He opened his defense by saying that he wished he had never been born. Now, he closed his defense by remembering the blessings that he and his family had enjoyed before this crisis occurred. I think that's a good reminder to all of us that we should try to see life in a balanced way. Yes, God permits us to experience difficulties and sorrows, but God also sends victories and joys. Let's never forget that. And as we've studied the book of Job, we've tried to find practical lessons that speak to us, to our situation, and in our day. In chapter 2 at verse 10, he asks, "Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil?" In other words, there is a balance of good things and bad things that comes into every life. I think Spurgeon said something interesting. He said, "Many people write their blessings in the sand, but engrave their sorrows in marble." Isn't that a good thought? And that is true. "Oh, that I were as in months past," he said, "as in days when God preserved me." He's looking back. You know, when we are in the midst of trials, it's natural for us to long for the good old days. But our longing will not change our situation. Someone has defined the good old days as a combination of a bad memory and a good imagination. Maybe so. But in Job's case, his memory was accurate, and the good old days really were good. By the way, there is a ministry in memory, if we'll use it properly. Moses admonished Israel to remember the way God had led them and cared for them. He's talking about that wilderness experience. Yes, it was difficult, but God preserved them and God provided for them. He provided the quail, He provided the manna, and He provided the water when they needed it. In fact, the word remember is found 14 times in the book of Deuteronomy, and the word forget is found 9 times. In days of disappointment, it's good to remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. But the past must be a rudder to guide us and not an anchor to hold us back. If we try to duplicate today what we experienced yesterday, we may find ourselves in a rut that robs us of maturity. It's interesting to me that Job mentioned as his number one joy the presence of God in his home. Now look, he's looking back. He's on the ash heap. He is suffering. He is not really aware of the fact that God is using him as a test case to show that faith would have the victory over Satan's schemes. God watched over him and shared his intimate friendship with him, verse 4. He's talking about the past now. The light of God was upon Job, and God's presence was with him and his family. God was the source of all of his wealth and success. And when his path was drenched with cream and the rock poured out streams of olive oil, that's the way he put it. And to those who lived in the East at that time, that was a description of wealth and happiness. Now, Job is continuing his thinking about the past. There is one especially interesting note in this opening statement in chapter 29. Job wished that he were back in the prime of life. Verse 4. Now, while this is a natural desire, it's also a dangerous one. If we focus so much on the glories of the past that we ignore the opportunities of the present, we may end up unprepared to meet the future. Let me repeat that. If we focus so much on the glories of the past that we ignore the opportunities of the present, we may end up unprepared to meet the future. And that future will come whether we like it or not. You know, few people eagerly anticipate old age and the special problems that it brings, but we can't avoid it. It's a proven fact that those who have the most birthdays live the longest, and those who live the longest become the oldest. And old people eventually die. You recall the never die jokes that you've heard maybe in the past, like old skiers never die, they just go downhill. Old bankers never die, they just fail to rise. Or I should say bakers, not bankers. Old football players never die, they just fumble away. Old golfers never die, they just lose their drive. We may think we will never die, but we will unless the Lord returns to take us first. So it's futile to look back with regret. It's faith to look ahead with rejoicing. Now, Job next listed the joy of respect that he had received from others in verses 7 through 11 here of chapter 29. When we walked through the city, the young man, he said, would step aside to let him pass. He had his seat at the city gate with the leading men of the city, and even they ceased their speaking when he arrived. Wherever he went, he was treated with respect and dignity. He says at verse 11, "Whoever heard me spoke well of me, and those who saw me commended me." Now his third source of joy was in his ministry to others, not only respect from others, but ministry to others. He mentions that in 12 through 17. What God gave to him, Job shared with others. Now you recall Eliphaz back in chapter 22. had accused Job of exploiting the poor and the needy. But Job denied that. And these verses describe the ministry of a compassionate man who brought help and happiness to many. Job strengthened righteousness and the justice in the city, verse 14. He helped the handicapped, he provided for the needy, he even defended the strangers. But Job did not stop with assisting the needy. He also confronted the wicked and broke their power, verse 17. Then he mentions one more thing, his confidence in the future. That was another source of joy to Job in a powerful way. And Job was sharing those blessings with others. So he had every reason to believe that life would continue the way that it had been going for years. He was confident that he would stay fresh and vigorous, live to an old age, and die in peace and glory. He saw himself as a deeply rooted tree that would go on bearing fruit, verse 19. His final source of joy was the privilege of speaking words of encouragement and help. He was like a Barnabas in his day, that is, a son of encouragement. His words were respected, appreciated. When he spoke, it was gentle and refreshing as the rain. When he smiled, it lit up the whole situation and gave people hope. Job's approval was like the dawning of a new day. Yes, Job had enjoyed a rich and rewarding life, but now all of that was gone and he's on the ash heap. But now, in chapter 30, Job considers God's judgment. From his delightful past, Job is suddenly thrust back into the dismal and disappointing present. You can almost hear him groan with his first words, "But now." Job was wise enough to know that he had to face the reality of the present and not escape into the memory of the past. People who refuse to come to grips with life are in danger of losing touch with reality, and soon they lose touch with themselves. His five complaints here parallels the joys that he named in chapter 29. Five of them. Look, he says, "I now have no respect. I now have no blessing. I now have no help, no future, and no ministry." Look at each of these just briefly. In verses 1 through 15 of chapter 30, young men who once stepped aside for Job now mocked him and even spat in his face. But the worst part of this experience was that these young men were the sons of men so despicable that Job compared their fathers to donkeys wandering in the desert. These men were unworthy to carry Job's sandals, and now they were openly ridiculing him. What made the difference? Well, Job was now an outcast like themselves. And then Job experienced sufferings similar to those that our Lord Jesus suffered. Have you ever thought about that? The basis of people falsely accused him. We see that with our Lord in Matthew 26. The basis of the people of that day spat upon him, verse 67, Matthew 26. They ridiculed him while he was even suffering, Luke 23:35. He became the song of drunkards. Job didn't know it, but he was being honored by God even to share in that distant day in the fellowship of our Lord's sufferings. And though sitting in an ash heap, Job had been promoted in the highest possible way. Now he says, "I have no blessings. Now the days of affliction have taken hold upon me," he groaned at verse 16. So what a contrast here with the days of cream and oil that he mentioned in 29. Job prayed to God, even stood up and cried out for deliverance, but his prayers now seemed to be unanswered. Verse 20, instead of God's hand helping him, bringing help to him, it only attacked Job ruthlessly and tossed him about like a feather in the storm. 21 and 22. So Job begged for his life, but death seemed inevitable. Then he said, I have no help. He had faithfully helped others in their need, as we saw in 29, but now nobody would help him. They listened to his words. They argued with him. They accused him, but nobody gave him help. In fact, he called his friends miserable comforters or physicians with no cure. You know, our motive in serving others is certainly not to obligate them to serve us back. We help others because we love Christ and we want to glorify Him, and because we sympathize with their needs and we want to help them. Then he said, I have no future, verses 26 through 28. During the days of his prosperity, Job had expected to enjoy a long and comfortable life and a peaceful death. But now that was all changed. He looked for good, but God sent evil. He looked for light, but God sent darkness. Instead of comfort and peace, he experienced constant turmoil within. In fact, at verse 27, he says, the churning inside me never stops. Now, in chapter 31, Job looks ahead for God's justice. This chapter records Job's final defense. It's like a legal document in which Job puts himself under oath before God and asks for judgment to fall if God can prove him wrong. Job's only hope was that God would hear his cry and vindicate his name. He could die in peace if he knew that his enemies had been silenced and that his reputation had been restored. In 16, verse 16, if I have statements, you know, and we were looking at several of those, as he reviewed his life and his relationships, he asks God, please pass judgment. I sign now my defense. Verse 35. In verses 33 through 37 here in chapter 31, Job asked God to give him three things. Give me a hearing, give me an answer to the charges, and a document to prove my innocence. In Job chapter 31, Job mentions three specific sins that could trap up any man's life. And that's true even today. He mentions these three: lust in the first four verses, deceit in 5 through 8, and adultery in 9 through 12. Now, lust is the first step toward sin, and sin is the first step toward death, we're told by James in chapter 1, 13 through 16. It's one thing to see and admire an attractive person, but it's quite something else to look for the purpose of lusting in the heart. And Jesus called attention to that. Everyone who is looking at a woman in order to indulge his sexual passion for her already commits adultery with her in his heart. Matthew 5 at verse 28. Then the second sin he mentions was that of deceit. Verses 5 through 8. He never used deception in his business dealings in order to make more money. In fact, he would even walk with those who did such things. His scales were honest, and he was not afraid for God to weigh him. His heart had not been covetous, nor with his hands defiled, because he had not taken what was not his. And if he was guilty of covetousness and deception, then Job was willing for his next season's crops to be taken by others. So he mentions lust, deceit, and here's the third one, adultery, in verses 9 through 12 of Job 31. Now, adultery begins with lust in the heart that leads to attempts to satisfy one's lustful desires. But Job said, I've never lurked about to see when my neighbor's wife would be alone. If he was guilty, then he was willing for his own wife to become another man's slave and mistress. He mentions that here. You know, adultery is a heinous crime that brings shameful and painful consequences in this life and judgment to come. And then in verses 13 through 15, Job makes reference to himself as an employer. He's so careful here in his self-examination that he even included his treatment of his servants in his household. Most masters in that day would have ignored this aspect of life. But Job treated his servants generously, and he settled their grievances fairly, because he knew that one day he would have to give an account to God. Then he speaks of himself as a neighbor in verses 16 through 23. In reply to the false accusations of Eliphaz, back in chapter 22, Job had already told how he had cared for the poor and the needy, but now he repeated it as a part of his oath. He was not boasting. He was defending himself before men and seeking vindication from God. If he had lifted his hand in court against any man, Job hoped that God would rip that arm from its socket. Job was concerned about the needs of widows, orphans, and the poor. He provided them with food and clothing and came to their defense in court. He even treated them like members of his own family, cared for them until they could care for themselves. You see, God had given Job his wealth, and God could take it away from him if he didn't share it with others. So Job was generous even to strangers, giving them food to eat and a place to spend the night. And then in verses 24 through 28, Job speaks of himself as the worshiper. He worshiped God. You see that scene in the very opening of the book. He served God. He worshiped God with his family. And he worshiped with a sincere heart. He didn't worship his wealth or trust it for his security, nor did he take credit for earning it. Now, Eliphaz had accused Job of making gold his god, but Job denied that. He had not worshiped gold, nor had he worshiped the heavenly bodies, as many of them did in that day. So if Job committed such a sin, men might not see it, but God would see it and would judge Job for being unfaithful to him. And then lastly, he spoke of himself as Job the steward. Who is a steward? A steward is one who must manage the goods of another. And in a very beautiful sense, every Christian is a steward. God has put things in our charge, and we are to manage our lives. We're to manage our blessings unto God's glory. What kind of a steward are you? Now, in verses 35 through 37, Job had completed his official demand for hearing and signed the document. Then he remembered one more area that needed to be covered: his stewardship of the land that God had given him. Job treated the land as though it were a person. If he had abused the land, it would have cried out against him and wept in pain. If Job's field hands had been overlooked and overworked and underpaid, then God would have had every reason to give Job a harvest of weeds instead of wheat and barley. Well, when Job's words were ended, everybody sat in silence, just wondering what would happen next. Would God send immediate judgment upon him and thus prove him guilty? Or would he accept Job's challenge, appear to him, and give Job opportunity to defend himself? Perhaps God would speak from heaven and answer all of the questions that Job had hurled toward him. Job had challenged God because he was sure that God would vindicate him. Job's three friends were sure that God would condemn him. So what will God do? You know, the answer may surprise you, and we'll get to that next time. Thank you so much for joining us today in this study.